Support comes from the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado, a proud partner of the public broadcasting stations that keep Coloradans better informed.
Good evening, and welcome to Outsources, a weekly KGNU program that provides you with content related to the queer community. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and today we're highlighting the work of writer, activist, and artist Elle Hearns. Elle is a partner of the Black Lives Matter movement, and her work with organizations like Get Equal and the Marsha P. Johnson Institute strives to build spaces of community and safety for Black trans women. I began our discussion by asking Elle about the barriers that are at play when addressing violence against Black trans women. You really work to center both, I think, the human impact of oppression as well as highlighting the systems and institutions in the United States that are supporting and upholding oppression. Where do you see the most significant barriers to combating violence, specifically violence against Black trans women?
It's at the institution level. Institutions have great power in being able to say who can and who can't, who will accept and who we won't. And so it is the role of institutions that then society follows and mimics. So there's great visibility around the murders of Black trans women without any conversations around what spaces killed them before someone actually murdered them. And so that is the work that I strive to do and that I strive to enforce other people to do so that equity is actually achieved as opposed to equality.
Yeah, it seems like one barrier is getting people to say the names and to acknowledge the names, but then another step entirely to, as you say, acknowledge those spaces that allowed for that violence. Do you find that people are reticent to go to that next step, to really take a hard look at those institutions?
No, because then people will have to assess their role in the institution and what institutional power they're hoarding in order so that they could sustain. So I don't think that people appreciate the discomfort in their own lives. They're much more invested in it in someone else's, because then people get to show up as a superhero as opposed to someone who also needs saved. And so it is the role of people within institutions that then inflict more harm than they do good. And I don't think that people acknowledge that we as humans have the capacity to do all of the above, do great things and do really horrible things.
Names, and you've mentioned this previously, names often are so important, and they figure really prominently, it seems like, in the work that you do and the messages that you give, and the names of people that have lost their lives to violence because of racism, sexism, transphobia. What does it mean to you to bring these names into the conversation?
Well, it means that I get to name white supremacy as being the culprit of their demise. Part of my work when I first started out was always acknowledging the names, always informing myself of these lives that lived, so that I wasn't just sprouting off names, but that I had an idea of who these people were, because they were human. They lived a full life, or at least the life that they could have based on the circumstances. And so part of my work now is challenging other people to learn these names and to form their own advocacy around people whose names have been, you know, elevated and not elevated, because there's so many names that we don't know. But also to name white supremacy as the culprit. And I think people shy away from that name. And that's actually the most important one, because that's the one that causes the demise and the one that we should all be working to end.
It seems like there's so much more conversation on a national scale about white supremacy, and yet still I think there's a sort of shying away from admitting the ways in which white supremacy infiltrates that discussion. Yeah. And even the people that are purporting to be against it, mm-hmm. You know, pointing to very visible figures in the alt-right rather than pointing to how white supremacy shows up on the left, for example, or in the Democratic Party, or, you know, these mm-hmm. establishments that might be seen as on the other side there.
Yeah, and it's really important that people recognize that the enemy is not one side against the other. The enemy is everyone. Like, everyone plays a role in the harm that someone else experiences. In a community that is disenfranchised, there are other communities that play a role in that. And so part of, this piece for me around institutions is really understanding why it's important for radical institutions to form. And radical institutions to then form with an analysis around anti-blackness, because there's a lot of attempts at radicalism, but there's not a lot of attempts to actually speak or center that there's a particular experience in this country that consistently is erased from being a factor into how everything else matriculates into a societal norm. So, you know, the institutions that infiltrate marginalized communities show themselves every single day. And it's much more than just an alt-right. And it's much more than inter-community violence. It's so much more than we allow it to be. And I think that is, for me, where I am in the conversation and also in terms of the actions that I take.
Yeah, it seems like, and I know you were even on CNN, you know, at one point talking about how, in essence, in some form or another, how well-intentioned white folks are standing in the way of the important work that you're doing.
Because the idea is to move forward.
Yeah.
It's to move forward without ever having to assess the conditions of what the root has been. And if you plant a tree but you don't water it, it's going to die. So it's like, let's build a house, but the infrastructure of the house is going to be funky, but we're still going to build the house because we need to get this house built. Your house is going to collapse. So for me, I think it's consistently important for everyone to continue to acknowledge who's in the way of liberation and who are we in the way of.
Yeah, and I think some of your comments, even, you know, throughout the election, from what I was able to tell, were really calling out common responses that white people have when confronted with these types of issues, mm-hmm. Or when confronted by the black community or black people specifically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a real barrier, too, because, I think there's a lot of talk about allyship or being an ally.
Yeah.
And especially in this time, you know, we've seen a lot of people stand up after the election and say, like, this doesn't represent us or this. And yet somehow still lacking those skills to really engage in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we saw this really heavily with the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, their strategies were dated. They attempted to infiltrate the movement with stale rhetoric. And they really relied on the black community as the blame and also the ones that were going to push them over. And that just wasn't the reality because, one, we did our part. Over 97% of black women that voted for Hillary. I took a lot of flack because I didn't vote. And I really felt like that was the best thing that I could have done for myself and what I believe in. And yeah, lots of thoughts about where we are currently. But I think that it's been really interesting to see the responses to where we are currently. And I've always been curious of what our responses would have been to a different form of whiteness in the White House.
Right. If the election outcome had been different, for example, we'd still be obviously dealing with white supremacy and these mm-hmm. issues. But
how we would be dealing with them would be much different. I think Donald Trump he's emboldened in a way that makes everyone else want to be emboldened. But if Hillary Clinton was passing the same policies quietly, the same conservative policies quietly, there wouldn't be the same response. Yeah, in my opinion.
How, I mean, you, the organizations you work for, I think, really speak to this need of acknowledging the ways in which systems of oppression like racism, classism, heterosexism intersect and impact each other, and that we can't really understand one without the context of the others. Mm-hmm. And how they interplay. How do you see this showing up on the ground, so to speak, in the work that you're doing?
Yeah, I think a lot of the ways is that you have a lot of dueling communities. You have a lot of, there's a lot of infiltration in terms of like narratives. So, you know, as trans people, there's narratives around violence and everyone wants to be visible in the violence. And so it's a lot of trumping of the other. And then there's a lot of folks who want to do coalition work, but struggle to do that work because there's not a foundation of politics. There's not a foundation of like what our principles are, and there's not a foundation of commitment. And I think part of the way that oppression and all of the symptoms of it work is to encourage those dynamics. I think what I've seen is a lot of great attempts and a lot of not so great attempts. For instance, the women's march is happening in a way that is not necessarily honoring the intersections as it wants to propel itself for people to believe. There's tokenization that's taking place with notable people of color being essentially the faces. And so you have all of these dynamics that are consistently and constantly showing up. And it's been fun, and I say fun because it's a colorful word to say it's been very hard and very difficult to continue to educate around the root as opposed to the hopefulness that everyone wants to have without ever taking a look at the cause of so much.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and we've been listening in on my conversation with artist and organizer Elle Hearns. Elle is the executive director of the Marsha P. Johnson Institute, which seeks to provide opportunities for connection and safety for Black trans women. In the first half of our show, we discussed her thoughts on the barriers to addressing racism and violence against Black trans women in the United States. We then started to discuss her thoughts on the notions of allyship, as well as her work to creatively envision new possibilities related to Black liberation. That just made me even sadder. I tried to keep myself busy. I ran around in circles, think I made myself dizzy. You talk to a variety of crowds and audiences about these issues, but what messages do you have for people interested in allyship and supporting Black women of color?
Mm-hmm. Ooh, well, part of that is you don't get to lead. You don't get to lead. You don't get to have ideas. You get to follow and you get to support. And I think a lot of people have good intentions, and then there are a lot of people who really just see the capital, they see the gain and what it means to be an allyship with communities that are constantly facing death. So I don't believe in allyship because I think allyship also is in the same bucket as equality. And I think those are two narratives that really interrupt our ability to actually be with each other. So the concept that I utilize is solidarity. But in order for solidarity to be achieved, there are certain steps, there are certain levels, and there's just training that has to happen, because if you come in contact with any marginalized community, you need to know how to respond. But you also need to know how to just be present. And I would definitely encourage allies or anyone who identifies in that way to figure out what it means to be present, and to also risk the same, if not more, that the people you want to be in allyship with are risking.
And so solidarity in that way really moves beyond this term of allyship or ally, you know, in addition to a term like equality, which I'm assuming is sort of used as a term to kind of smooth things over or state a good intention, but maybe not have an impact.
Or to equate. And I think, you know, for me as a Black woman, I'm never interested in being equal to anyone white. That's not my politic. It's not what I believe in. I truly believe in Black power. And so, you know, equality also gives the false hope that we will all have the same experiences. And the reality is colonization will never allow us to have the same experiences. So, you know, it's kind of like a dead end. It's like turning down the wrong street and going down a dead end when you enter conversations that way. Because there is no strategy that will actually support us ever being equal in this country or in this world. And I don't like to play pretend.
It seems like a part of the vital nature of the work you do is about this envisioning of spaces for collaboration, for community, amidst significant violence against Black trans women in particular. What does this look like for you, though, as you're envisioning and moving towards liberation and a different future, again, grounded in this understanding of the ways in which white supremacy of oppression is at work and kind of the root cause?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for me, the vision requires resistance always. And the ways that we form our resistance, it has to take shape in so many ways. It's part of the reason why, you know, art is so important to me. You know, I think about my ancestors, my elders, and they've always had different outlets for their resistance. Part of the reason why the Marsha P. Johnson Institute exists is because Marsha P. Johnson was such a figure at resisting outside of the normal, I'm going to get on a megaphone and yell and scream and shout. Her very living was resistance and was a model of what the future would look like if liberation was won. Our folks would be free. But our folks would be free in themselves. And that's really what I believe in and what I dream of. And part of what causes me to do the work and to go to places where it ain't no Black faces is because everyone does play a part. Not necessarily in my liberation, because I can do that on my own, but everyone plays a part in the world's ability to liberate itself from, you know, 600 years of colonization that just continues to influence the ways that history repeats itself. So, you know, that's the place that I'm in, the place that I'm always in is around collaboration and really ensuring that other people outside of just myself have the ability to show up in whatever resistance way makes sense for their lives.
It's so interesting hearing you talk about liberation. I mean, I think so often another thing that seems to happen is that especially white folks get really excited about being a part of Black liberation rather than thinking about dismantling systems of whiteness and white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And I think this notion that white people shouldn't be involved in Black liberation or there isn't a way in which they can be involved that will be helpful mm-hmm. is a tough pill to swallow mm-hmm. for
white people
for
hate
white
to hear
people.
It.
Right.
Because that's the thing about the way that white supremacy works. White supremacy tells white people that they are always needed, that they always have to have a role. And when it comes to Black liberation, you don't have to have a role in that. Black people have been more than capable of creating our own freedom. We were free. and we found ways to get free when our freedom was taken from us. So I think part of really understanding white supremacy is understanding just the basics of concepts that there is work to be done for white people, but you don't get to free us. We're capable, highly capable. Everything that this world operates off of, we created. There'd be no economic system without our labor. So it's just something that I think white people should always consistently think of when they decide that they want to be excited about liberation that does not belong to them.
Yeah, it's such an interesting, I so appreciate this viewpoint because it, you know, you're still coming from a place of collaboration and partnership, but really reframing what that looks like, you know, and I think, again, there's a lot of reticence among those in power or with privilege to, mm-hmm. to see it that way. Mm-hmm. But could you talk more about the Marsha P. Johnson Institute? I mean, this is something that was started in 2015.
It was, yes.
So, and, you know, so it's still kind of in this exciting stage, right?
It's in a very exciting stage. It's in a very new stage. It's in a exploration stage. But that's my hope, is that the organization, the Institute, will always be in a space of exploration. Because that's the beautiful thing about gender identity. And just identity in general, it's never certain. It's never, for me, I just like to end it. It's just never. And I think that's part of the thing that I want Marsha to be able to do, is to constantly think of ways that she can exist in the lives of people who need the Institute. And yeah, it's new. Part of, you know, the difficulties about developing a new, anything new is the weight of developing other things that are new. And so my time was really encapsulated by developing and organizing the Black Lives Matter Network, which is, you know, the particular role that I played as a strategic partner, but also as an organizer for the network, was figuring out what is the ways to get 42 chapters across the country to collaborate and to be with each other around, you know, our politics and also, you know, who we are holding accountable. But now I'm in a space where I have seen the fruits of my labor with Black Lives Matter, and I'm able to really invest my time in the Marsha P. Johnson Institute, which for me is always been the baseline, or at least the standard that I've held in the current iteration of Black resistance, and also for whatever the future holds.
You've also alluded to and talked about art and creating, and not necessarily that that's opposed to organizing, but that there's a place for that as well. Where do you see art creation playing into, you know, your own ideas, your own exploration, as you were talking about?
It's been a part of my healing. It's been a part of what's made me whole, is having the ability to express myself, but to express myself, whether it's through music or to hear myself expressed through someone else's art, has been inspiring. And it's also, I think, a huge part of our ability to dream of a world that doesn't exist, is our ability to create. We get to create what that world is, and art really gives us the place to model and create a vision, literally.
As you continue to engage in this work, I'm just wondering how you're continuing to find the energy to stay engaged. And yeah, you know, I imagine that, you know, that art perhaps plays a role, but that energy to stay engaged and to hold on to that expansive thinking.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's very difficult, because one of the things I was kind of sitting on the other day, someone texts me a quote from an article, and it was a quote from me in an article, and I was like, okay, why are you sending this to me? This is strange. And I looked at the quote, well, I looked at the article that the quote was from. It was from 2 years ago. And so I was really perplexed, because I just didn't understand why something that I said from 2 years ago was coming to me right now. So it just became very clear that there's one or two things that's happening. It's either this is how long it takes for messaging to actually reach the community you want it to reach, or we have not had any growth or development in the rhetoric that our movements are generating. And so people are searching for rhetoric and things, and this is what they're coming up with. So for me, that reflected the place that I've been in. I've been bored. I've been very, very bored. Because you know, at the beginning of my work, it was an exciting time. It was just an exciting time. Social media was being utilized in ways for organizing that no one had ever experienced. And we were finding new ways to connect with communities of people that were marginalized. And now those tactics have become the norm. And overutilized. And so it's been difficult to figure out what are new ways to engage in the work, what are new ways to engage new topics, or to explore new concepts around not only white supremacy, but the joy of Blackness. And so that's where I find my hope and my creativity is in the conversations around the joy that's possible through art and through organizing and through community, intentional community. And that's, yeah, that's just where I'm finding joy, because I went through a period where it was very dark. And the beautiful thing about being trans is that there's been many dark times before. So there's not much I can't get through, but it's been challenging and also fun finding new ways to engage and create. And that's when I'm at my best. That's when I can't lose. It's when I'm creating.
That's the way every day goes. Every time we've no control. If the sky is pink and white, if the ground is black and yellow, it's the same way you showed me. Not my head, don't close.
You've been listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver. I'm Sean Kenny, and you've been hearing my recent conversation with Elle Hearns. For more information about Elle Hearns, including links to more information about her work, go online to our website at news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about today's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org. It's all